You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Good evening once again, Greenbelt. Welcome to Pagoda. Our venue is bigger, better, faster, more, thanks to CCLA Investment. And we are hugely grateful to them for their beautiful venue that we invite you into tonight. To listen to our great panel, introduced by Vicky Walker, writer, speaker, broadcaster, whose book explored how faith and personal relationships interact. We're here with Christian Connection. Has anybody been to any of their events? Way. Christian Connection landed at Greenbelt 25 years ago and is a place where Christian singles can come and get together for friendship and community and maybe even loving relationship. And so we are delighted to welcome our panel, supported by Christian Connection. Over to you, Vicky.
Thank you very much. Hello, everybody. It's great to see you all here for this non-contentious, completely calm topic of dating, relationships, love, just, you know, the tiny little minor things in life that we never think much about. So I have an amazing panel here to talk to you tonight. I'm going to introduce them all. To my right is Lamorna Ash. Lamorna is a writer and journalist. Her debut, Dark Salt Clear: Life in a Cornish Fishing Town, won a Somerset Maugham Award, was shortlisted for the Wainwright Prize, and was a BBC Radio 4 Book of the Week. Her new book, Don't Forget We're Here Forever, follows research with 20 to 30-year-olds exploring why a generation is turning to faith in uncertain times and what it means for belonging and connection. Which is a fantastic book. To Lamorna's right is Chinny McDonald, writer, broadcaster, author, and director of Theos, the religion and society think tank. She speaks and writes regularly on issues of race, faith, and agenda, and is the author of God Is Not a White Man and Other Revelations, and Unmaking Mary, Shattering the Myth of Perfect Motherhood, also fantastic books. She is also the vice chair of Greenbelt Festival and a trustee of Christian Aid and Demos. She is on the advisory board for Cambridge University Library and is a canon theologian at Chester Cathedral. A busy woman, indeed. To my left is the one and only Seth Pinnock, Birmingham-born singer-songwriter and social entrepreneur. He leads the Joy Factory, which includes Symphonico and CNB, supporting young leaders, community projects and creative campaigns. An architecture graduate, he previously headed African and Caribbean engagement at Tier Fund and has produced, drum roll, has produced and presented projects for TVN UK. Seth works with churches, charities and brands to build inclusive platforms where people and ideas can grow. And to Seth's left is Beth Chan, who is Communications Director at Single Friendly Church Network, the UK charity helping churches welcome and include single adults. She has led their campaigns and communications for 8 years, developing resources for churches and speaking and writing on singleness and church culture in Christian media. Beth is also a pop artist and songwriter who has connected with large audiences through her songs about singleness and dating. So, thank you all for being here. So we are looking forward to an engaging and thoughtful session tonight, a non-confrontational session. We are really wanting to just explore what is going on in dating at the moment and relationships and love and what's changing. Obviously, technology is having a huge effect and we're going to touch on that as well. But my first question is going to be, I think everyone could contribute to this, starting with Beth. Maybe we'll just go left to right. Are we at a cultural turning point as the role of dating apps and the shape of relationships changes?
Oh, and that's a big question, isn't it? I mean, I think that we are kind of changing at a point where people, obviously most people are meeting now on dating apps, but at the same time, I know that recently, more recently, people are kind of pushing away from that as well and actually seeking more authentic in-person connections. But I think dating is happening more than ever. I mean, I work for Single Friendly Church. We know that 40% of UK adults are single, and that is rising every year, and people are choosing to get married later. And if they are getting divorced or separated, then they're then staying single again for longer. And then they're single again at the end of their life for longer as well. So singleness is increasing. And that means that people, I think they're, people are also feeling better about being single, perhaps not in the church, which we maybe can talk about at some point. But I think in society, there is an increasingly positive rhetoric about being single. And, you know, I feel like gone are the days of Bridget Jones, where everyone's like, you know, got to get married off, or perhaps I'm looking for someone to complete me. And now it's like, I'm complete by myself. And maybe now I'm looking for someone to kind of add something to my life. So that's what I would say.
Thank you, Beth. That's brilliant. Seth, what do you think? Are we at a cultural turning point?
Oh, my God.
Just a light question to start you off.
I think we're at a cultural turning point, but I'd also think that there's a lot of pressure to perform and do all the things that people are saying means that you're a great human being. And for some, the idea of being married or having that significant other for a long time speaks to one's ability to be a cool, whole human being. And that's a lot of pressure.
Well, I suppose the important cultural touchstone, and just like that, came to an end recently. If anyone watched it, it's the like updated version of Sex and the City. And surprisingly, it ends with Carrie happily alone, choosing no one but loving her friends. And that, I think, should tell us a lot about where we are today. So kind of speaking to what you were saying about friendship and stuff, I guess people talk about lethargy in terms of dating apps. There's, you know, we have it with our WhatsApps as well, the sense of like overload of all these messages all the time and desiring to go back to meeting people in pubs and bars and maybe like to relearn that muscle again. I guess something that I've found as well among my friends, which is like quite a particular kind of like queer group, but then there's also this like rise in polyamory and these like ways of trying to think about new ways of doing relationship that does feel distinct, that's separate from this idea of cheating, that attempts to be non-hierarchical that often goes wrong, messiness with dating, same thing of like if we're staying single throughout our 30s, if we're all living in massive group shares, which if you're in your 30s you likely are, or at least I am, meaning that like you already have this larger community living together. Partners come into that. The shape of it is very different from nuclear families who are separated off and maybe sometimes isolated. There's bits that are challenging that, but there's also potential for so much beauty in those shifts that are caused by economic crisis.
Well, I think I want to talk about three things: choice, politics and polarization, and technology. I think we're absolutely at a cultural shift. I think the shift has been quite rapid in the recent years, even in the past decade. So firstly, choice. I had an interesting conversation with a colleague this week, and we were thinking about doing some kind of research on couples and the kind of judging or kind of measuring the distance between the places in which the people were born. So we're having many more people getting into relationships with people who are from completely different places. So my husband and I, he was born in Yorkshire, I was born in Lagos. Like that's a lot of miles in between. The world is changing. So people are partnering with people who are completely different from them. But I also think choice in terms of, I don't think the paths set out for us today are the same as what my parents' generation or my grandparents' generations were. So people often, marriage was like the just the next thing that you did after graduating from university or finishing school, and you probably married someone who lived somewhere near where you were from. There's also choice in terms of the types of relationships, and also that's exacerbated, I think, by technology. So dating apps, online dating, AI, chatbots, all of this stuff, and then politics and polarization. So I think one of the things that I hear from people is that our polarized culture is showing up in dating apps. So we are, I think, you know, 20 years ago, you might have been up for meeting someone who had a completely different political viewpoint because you didn't know at that stage. You might find out a few dates later, whereas people are kind of putting things on their kind of dating profiles like no Tories or no vaccinated people or whatever. So, yeah, interesting times.
Yeah, just a bit.
On that dating app thing, I have a friend who's Christian, and she's queer, and she'd put that she was a Christian on a dating app, and this person started talking to her and then was like, not for me, Christian. And then 4 years later, she saw the same person on a different dating app, and the person said, I've been looking for you. I've become way more spiritual in the interim, and I'm well up for a date. And I just thought it was a really good story.
Keep us updated on that one. That's going to unfold, isn't it? Well, my next question really touches on what you just said, Lamorna, about the new shapes of dating. And the question is really, what does ethical dating look like? Because we all obviously are seeing people not necessarily behaving amazingly, and sometimes. What does ethical dating look like? What should it look like? And why can it be so hard to do in practice? Would you like to talk about that?
Me?
Yeah.
Ethical dating. Ooh. Gosh, I guess it's really hard to know where to go with this question. I get ultimately there is that sense of the levels of trust that you need in another, the basic levels of decency towards someone and kindness and generosity that, like, I hope we all do within dating. I think there's so much more language around that. I guess, like, a lot of people have had, like, sort of therapy language that then sometimes can get used quite strangely within the dating world. It's like weaponized, perhaps, that sometimes makes me more nervous, I guess. But ultimately, like, in my sense, the ethics of dating are transparent. Do you know what? I have, like, no rules or lines about this, but I suppose, like, at least telling the person if you are dating other people, that kind of transparency feels good. But I actually don't really have a stance at all on the ethics of dating beyond not being an asshole and treating people well off the dating apps. I don't think I've got much more to say about it.
Okay, good line there. Okay, Seth, I'm going to come to you next. What is ethical dating and why is it so hard to do?
It's easy.
Okay, all right, we've got an answer.
What is ethical dating? I think, okay, I'm going to externally process. So I think for myself, it is trying to orientate myself around what I call the golden rule: love God, love people, and love yourself. And if I orientate myself around those three things, then my ethics towards that person or persons should match, including the way that I love myself. I recently came out as queer a year ago, and thanks, everyone said woo. Going from one that was in the closet and in the church to one that is now out and also still very much a church boy, navigating the ethics of being with people or dating people that are on different sides of their theology or their sexual sense of morality or what's good or what's bad, etc., has been a journey. And so for me, I've had to kind of anchor myself around those three golden rules. I think transparency speaks to that. I think self-worth speaks to the way that you are ethically engaging with people. I think trust is a big deal there. Just not being an arsehole, really. That's super important. But I think not being an arsehole to yourself. I think the way that you love and like yourself reflects it to the way that you treat other people. And I had to learn, especially with coming out, to love and like myself. And if I love and like myself, then I'm not going to disrespect you. I'm going to try my best to not disrespect you. And that bleeds into the way that I date.
I feel like I have a lot I could say about this. But I think there's just a lack of accountability, I think, in online dating, because you're not dating in community. And so people don't even know that you're going on dates often, and people don't know who you're dating. They don't know who you're not dating. And if there aren't any connections between you, it's very easy to, you know, not treat someone well and get away with it. And no one's going to challenge you on your behavior. So I think, yeah, we need to be challenging our friends if we see, for example, them ghosting people or not being transparent. Like, I think we need to do that more. And I would say, yeah, just, I mean, as you guys have said, just being honest, and also just being honest about how you feel about that person, perhaps. I went on a date, a second date with someone, and at the end of the date, they said, you know what, Beth, I'm not really sure that I'm feeling this romantically, but he was like, but you know what, I'll give it one more date. And, you know, let's just see, you know, like, I don't feel like we've had enough time yet, so let's just give it one more try. And even though that's not like the best thing that you want to hear after a date, if you like the person, I appreciated the honesty. And then I went into the third date knowing, like, with a little bit less pressure. I was like, okay, well, we'll just give it one, you know, we'll just see what happens, we'll see how we both feel. And then at the end of the third date, he pulled into the car park and just looked at me and was like, Beth, yeah, I'm not feeling it, how are you feeling? But it was great because I was like, okay, cool, we added each other on Instagram, never spoke again, but at least I knew where we stood, you know. Whereas I feel like for some people, you know, you could just keep texting them and maybe they'll ghost, or maybe they'll kind of lead you on because perhaps they want to have someone to text and they want to have someone to have that communication and that connection with, but they're not really interested in you. So I think just honesty is, yeah, just really important.
Chinny, do you have a neat slogan for ethical dating?
No, I don't. But I think I think it's just much easier online to be an asshole, isn't it? Because you're not, as you say, you're not in community, you're not meeting that person, you're not kind of... you're not being challenged by them. You can kind of show up as whoever you want. And I think we see that with just the way that people behave on social media in general. If you kind of go on X or Twitter, people will say things to people that they would never say to someone's face because it just feels easier to be able to do that, and to be able to kind of potentially show the worst sides of our humanity rather than the best. So I think ethical dating is about kind of not doing that, trying to act and treat someone as if they were literally right there in front of you. Obviously, you might eventually meet them, but I think that there's a lot of kind of keeping on doing the kind of chatting online.
Yeah,
in that way, like, phones are a barrier to ethical dating. Like, the technology is a barrier to ethical dating. I also think then on that as well, that thing of like swiping and like making these strange choices based on what you think you might like on a two-dimensional image of a person, compared to like the unexpected frisson of sexiness with someone who you just happen to fancy and you literally cannot predict what that's going to be. And I think you're more likely to do ethical dating when you meet in person, because that thing of like being slightly undone by the other, by being like, wow, another person, totally changes your attitude. So I think it's one of those things where I'm like, I wouldn't blame any of us for this. As ever, technology often can make us so much lesser versions of ourselves.
So maybe the ethical thing to do is meet online and then meet in person as soon as possible. And then
absolutely.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah. Well, we got a slogan out of that from at least three quarters of the group, which is don't be an arsehole. So if you take nothing else away from today, there you go. What role should romantic relationships play in our lives, and how long should they last? Statistics show divorce rates are dropping. Are we getting better at love? Are we not getting married as much? Are we getting married later? Beth, I think you might have something to say about this one. You were talking about people staying single longer.
Yeah, I think people are staying single longer because, yeah, I think it is more acceptable. And I think we have more options now. Like, I mean, it practically and financially speaking, it is actually quite hard to be single still. And there's a lot in the news about kind of the cost of living, kind of living by yourself, which is why, as you said, like Lamorna, that a lot of people are living in community because, you know, really you just can't afford to live by yourself as well. But yeah, I think romantic relationships are important if that's what you want, but yeah, they're not everything. And I think friendship is something that isn't really spoken about enough as like one of the most important relationships. And yeah, single people need friends, but so do married people. And I think, you know, we can't put all of our kind of relational needs on one person and hoping that they're going to fulfill that. You know, we need friends. And I think we have friends for different things as well. You know, we have the friends we have the deep chats with. We have the friends that we have fun with. We have the friends that perhaps we share a particular interest with. And it's just, yeah, just acknowledging that one person can't fulfill all of those needs, and that's okay.
Seth, what do you think? Obviously, you're navigating new spaces, new time in your life.
Real new time in my life. I think friendships and community has been it's been an interesting thing for me to build new community and new friendships and grieve old friendships and old communities. It's been a beautiful thing for me to enter into rooms and be my most authentic self, and find buddings in those spaces, but also the pain of being who I am now and navigating this and loving this and the joys that have come from this, but not being able to show those that have helped me to get there, that I'm here now. Does that make sense? And that's been quite tough. And so friendships, the new friendships I'm finding are everything to me, because I'm learning about myself all over again. I've got some friends that are now saying, oh, we should do friendiversaries. So like let's go on a friendship day. We've been friends for 1 year now and we're going to celebrate that. And that's dope. Like, why not? So I'm leaning more into what it is to have authentic, long-term, long-standing friendships with people that have become chosen family.
Oh, so nice. I know the feeling. I was kind of saying a couple of years ago coming out. My best mate Sammy's got this line that I always use, that I think they got from somewhere else, which is treat your friends more like lovers and your lovers more like friends. And I think it's a really good one, of this sense of like that sort of making special your friendships, but also then like slightly deplatforming, or like at least taking down from the hierarchy or romantic relationships as something dissimilar from other relationships as the absolute main thing. I say this, of course, every time I fall in love, I absolutely prioritize that for a while because it's really hard not to, and it's intoxicating, but it's a nice idea to do that. On the like how long relationships last, Miranda July, who wrote this wicked book last year called All Fours, that I imagine people here have read, that was kind of amazing. It was about kind of coming out and leaving a marriage for a woman. But she has this amazing Substack, and she talks about this idea of every relationship has its season, and what's really important is us working out how long that season is. And I suppose, again, this is quite like maybe like a secular thing to say, you know, kind of speaking about Christianity, of, you know, that this sense, although this is a space in which I suppose like people think have loads of different positions about divorce, about like what, you know, what it is to be loyal to someone. Is a part of trust and loyalty really knowing when it's time to separate as well? And I think I've found it's made my life a bit easier to imagine that every relationship I have has a season, and to kind of accept gracefully when you're like, do you know what, we can't do this any longer. And that requires you both to kind of really be thinking within the relationship, be really active about it together. And you know, some of my best moments ever have been like beautiful short flings, which I've learned a huge amount from. And then also these like seismic shifting relationships you have as well. And there's the need for all of them, I think, in life. And it's kind of a joy that we get to do that.
Ginny, are we getting better at love?
No, I don't think we are. I think humans just have always been, a mixed bag of experiences and the ways that we treat people, and good at relationships and not good at relationships. I think I find it interesting the kind of lower divorce rates and people getting married later. So I was trying to think about what I think about that. And I think it reminded me, I grew up in an evangelical Christian church, and I wasn't married by the time I was 25. So I thought my life was over. Like, I don't know. So, and I think about a lot of people who did get married very, very young, some of whom are, you know, very much still together, but quite a few who are no longer together, because there's so much change that happens in a human being in those years that I can understand why it would be, you'd become a different person and realise that that's not necessarily what you wanted your life to be. So I think there's probably a correlation between getting married later and divorce rates being lower, because you kind of have done your growing up, maybe. Maybe controversial. I'm sure there are lots of people who got married early and are very, very happy. But I wasn't married at 25.
No. There's a counter to every point, isn't there? Because there's also a stat that says that after divorce or widowhood, men are more likely to remarry and women are more likely to decide they like being single. So read into that what you will. There are always so many stats and fascinating stories. So I'm going to move on a little bit now to the issue of AI, which is obviously everywhere you look in the news. It's the thing that is being talked about as the new revolution. It's going to be as big as the printing press. It's going to change everything that happens to us everywhere we look at the world. Who knows? But it certainly does give us the opportunity to date differently and to have relationships differently. So what do we think the impact will be of the rise of AI and technology on our ability and desire to form genuine human connections?
I've got quite a good story that I my friend wrote this big piece about looking at AI girlfriends and AI boyfriends, AI, you know, different kinds of people, but that you can have these AI chatbots that then audibly, a bit like that film Her, if people have seen that, will talk back to you. But what there was this amazing case where there was this guy who was being prosecuted for attempting to kill the Queen back when the Queen was still alive, and his defence was that his AI girlfriend had encouraged him to do it. And what that came down to was that what the AI girlfriend does is validate everything you say. So in the chain of text, it's like him saying, I think I should kill the Queen, and his AI girlfriend saying, go for it, babe. And I think there's this danger of, like, part of the beauty of relationships is the conflict, is the fact of someone saying to you, I'm not sure about that, or pushing against you, helping you to be a better version of yourself, loving you, being difficult, being challenging in response to your difficulties and challenges. And if AI, the way it's designed, is to just validate us and mirror what we're saying, that makes us less able to change and grow. I also think it's important to think about, I was reading about this, what it means that, like, the majority of tech bros, the people who are designing the AI models, are a particular kind of often wealthy white guy in San Francisco who have specific ideas about how the world ought to be. And so it's not just a neutral tool, AI, at all. And so thinking about the politics with that, of, like, if we're going to allow that to change the way we date, where is that going to take us? And so people talk a lot about alternative models, like needing to get more young people from more backgrounds into AI to make it a more exciting, diverse, interesting, complicated, strange tool. And I think that sounds quite positive, if that was possible.
Yeah. I love that the ultimate warning is, if it tells you to kill the Queen, just don't do it. Or King. Don't kill any royal family members. Actually, they're treason, basically. Seth, what do you think the impact of AI and technology is on our ability to have genuine human relationships?
I agree with everything you've said. I, like, absolutely. But I also... I also think that it is a tool, and it's not going away, and it's here, and we're using it, and people are using it, and younger people are using it. And I think there's an interesting democratization that it offers to people to work out and play pit and playground thoughts and ideas that they probably don't have access to other spaces to navigate those kind of questions. And I know friends or younger folk that are using AI as, rightly or wrongly, as, you know, I'm in a contentious space with somebody. I want to just work this out. How best do I say this? Because I know that last 16,000 relationships, I said X, Y, Z, and that didn't work out quite well. And I've got no one else to talk to about this. And so I think it lowers the barrier to entry for me to begin to critically think, for me to begin to therapize, me begin to talk to somebody that I'm thinking about, the kid that might be in Nigeria that is, you know, has a secret boyfriend and too afraid to talk to him about it, and just going on his little ChatGPT, and that's the place for him to do that. And so I've got grace for that, but I also do agree with everything that you've just said. But it is definitely here, and I've definitely used it.
Beth, what have you seen in your work?
I'm not sure how much we've seen in our work, but I have to say, yeah, I'm not an AI fan. And I think it's because I'm worried that it's going to change, it's going to stop my ability to be able to think for myself. And I think in terms of dating and relationships, I guess that the issue might come in that everyone's getting AI to write their dating profiles and to write their conversations for them. Yeah. So actually, when they meet up with someone in person, they're not going to know how to communicate with them, or perhaps they've been giving off perhaps a perfect image of themselves, and, you know, like these perfect witty kind of jokes or like chat up lines or whatever it is. And then you meet in person and you just don't have the same chat because you haven't been presenting yourself as who you are.
Ginny.
So I have many, many thoughts on this because I've been thinking a lot about it recently. I think there's a difference between using ChatGPT to get advice to help you in your real life relationships. I think that you know, I'm actually quite pro ChatGPT and AI kind of for various different things. But what I have realized is that there is a really terrifying world out there I'm currently reading a book called The New Age of Sexism by Laura Bates. And there are so many AI girlfriend chatbot things. If you kind of, if you were to search on your kind of Play Store or App Store now, you would find so many different companies with these kind of chat, these girlfriends, online girlfriends, that are created by companies by that are run by white tech bros who have a very specific view about women. So I am terrified of the misogyny that is, you know, out there in society, but it's being played out even more with these kind of these AI girlfriends. And what Laura Bates explores is the coercive control that kind of men predominantly can practice with these AI girlfriends, the sexual assault that they can kind of practice. And then these AI girlfriends just kind of are happy and they say the things that the men want to hear. So what does that do to the men when they therefore see women out in real life? What are they thinking about them? Because their AI girlfriend is like their ultimate, like it's saying and doing what they want. So people are marrying their AI girlfriends, but people have always been weird, right? people have married, you know, women have married pavements or fairgrounds or cars or, like, people have always been odd. I think it's playing into a very kind of, a very kind of human thing, which is to anthropomorphize technology. Yeah. And I just think we're just going to see more and more and more of this. It just needs to be brought out into the open.
Yeah, and I guess it's the validation that comes from that now that is kind of a newer thing. So AI offers the opportunity to change or perfect ourselves with ChatGPT written messages, enhanced photos, deepfake videos. Apparently, if you want to know if someone is a deepfake video, you should get them to waggle their tongue from side to side on the call, because that's something that it can't do yet. So great way to break the ice if it turns out they're real. But that's a little tip if you happen to be doing that. Should we accept some of these enhancements as part of modern life? Or should we say, no AI here, please? What's your kind of view? Should we accept that some of this is just a way to get over the hurdles to initially meet and then you become yourself? Or anyone got a strong view on whether AI should be part of dating with all these tools?
I don't think that it should, but I can understand if you've never written a dating profile before and perhaps like you just... Or that's a real barrier to you. Like, how do I present myself online? Like, I have so much that I could say. Like, I mean, I've been on some, for example, Christian Connection. I think you can write as much as you like. And some people would just give you their whole life story. And that is, I find that very intense. And so actually being able to like say to AI, hey, this is what I want to say. Can you condense that and make it more kind of appealing? I feel like something like that would be okay. But, you know, asking it to write something which makes it then inauthentic to you, I feel like that's probably when it's more of an issue.
So what do you think?
I think I sound like I've got a bit too much grace for AI, but no, I do.
It's good.
But I think it's more of the same. I think we've been enhancing like forever. When you go on a date, you put some makeup on, you get your hair cut, you get your nails did. That's enhancements to an extent, you know. All those kind of things. And so I think it's more of the same. We're magnifying and probably bringing to the forefront what already is. And then, there's nothing new under the sun, I think.
So enhancing what's real, not inventing something.
Yeah, yeah. And Maya Angelou says, when people show you who they are, believe them the first time. And so eventually you're going to figure out who that person really is and you can govern yourself accordingly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm with you both on Beth and Stefan, like taking how you can harness the tool. But I guess Maya Angelou didn't think that, like, what if that first time was a version that you put into a chatbot and then it's like you shifted it. Like, there is like a sense of being like getting further from yourself through that. I guess I was thinking about it even just imagining with texting someone of like getting an AI to alter what you're saying to give you the perfect response. And I think in real conversation, like the beauty of working things out together one-on-one, of like someone says something surprising that requires you to say something and you surprise yourself in that way, I think that's like, you know, it's why theatre is so amazing, like that magic of what dialogue feels like. It it's a shame to lose those things because we spend so much time speaking via, even just thinking about like WhatsApping friends, I can take an hour to wait to respond to someone. And therefore like it's really like altered or like estranged what that kind of dialogue actually feels like. So I think it's a shame to lose those kinds of things. But I think as we're saying, I guess like what we keep coming to is this sense of like both of like accepting those augmented things, seeing that it's valuable, and also making sure that we have enough time in the real world as well to keep the balance.
And I think it will also make real, authentic, vulnerable, truthful moments even more powerful than they've ever been. I think about what it's like to receive a handwritten letter now from someone. That's something I would I treasure and like put in a memory box compared to an email or a text message, which is just like every day. And so I think those real, like face-to-face moments, sharing food, sharing meals, meeting each other, I think that they're going to mean so much more than they have before.
I think if we're talking about kind of deep fake online dating, I think we're in a different, it's definitely a continuation of human kind of behavior, which is to be quite shallow or to have certain perceptions about what an attractive person is or what an attractive person looks like. So I can understand why someone who didn't feel like they conformed to that stereotype or box would use kind of, you know, extreme enhancements digitally. I can't even like imagine what this means, but to be able to have at least for some time a relationship with someone who might not look at them in real life. The problem, though, I think, is that it will lead to fewer people meeting in real life, because if you have created a fake version of yourself online, you know that when you then meet that person, you'll then be judged in a different way. And then to have to deal with the disappointment of that would, I think, be really bad for people. So I was thinking about Catfish, the MTV. Oh, I feel like Greenbelt is. Has anyone ever heard of Catfish?
I loved it.
Right.
Yeah.
So Catfish fans. In the old days, it was good. Where you'd have these people who would enter into kind of years-long relationships online with people, but they would never show themselves on camera. They would never send pictures of themselves. And eventually, they would be tracked down, and they wouldn't be people who conform to what is stereotypically beautiful. So I just think it would just be more and more of that, very long relationships, and not meeting the real people.
Well, I know we want to do some questions from all you lovely people out there as well. So I'm going to ask one last question to the panel before we open that up. So in a world that often feels disconnected, what does hope in the making, the theme of the festival, look like in dating and relationships?
I think technology is a tool to make connection. It is not the point of the connection. So as we said, like the shorter the amount of time you can, you know, have a digital relationship and meet someone in real life, I think the better. But there are so many amazing stories of people who have met online, who have met their soulmates. I was talking to my colleague this week who met her husband online, and they both done kind of dissertations or PhDs on like 17th century Quakerism, or, you know, it was so niche, and yet it was technology, online dating, that brought them together. So I just think there are some beautiful stories. I think we should just use it as a tool rather than the end.
I think that another cool thing about people marrying later and therefore having more opportunity to date, I heard this other really nice line by Anais Nin, who said that each time you meet someone, what that does is they open the possibility of another world inside you that you didn't know existed. And so the more of these like, beautiful encounters we get, the more worlds we get to open inside ourselves. And I was thinking that, I mean, like, in my dating life, each new person, I'm like, oh, wow, I see a whole new me through being with this person. And I think it's the same both way. And obviously, there's pain and difficulty and anguish involved in dating and dating your 20s and 30s and not sort of finding a person that you want to spend the rest of your life with. But there is also opportunity then to work out all these different versions. That's like my hopefulness about dating as it stands today, that feels exciting to me.
Seth, what do you think?
I think in a world where AI and augmented stuff and tech as a tool is going to make everything so perfect, authenticity and vulnerability is going to be the absolute truth, and people are going to gravitate towards that more than ever before. And so my hope is that we continue to lean into showing up as our most authentic self, being, you know, vulnerable, being transparent, being truthful, being human, beautifully human, because that is what's going to cut through the noise of the AI perfection.
From a kind of online dating perspective, I met my husband online, so it's possible. And so, yeah, I think that you can create real meaningful relationships. And I don't think we would have met, you know, if it weren't for meeting on a dating app. I think in terms of authenticity, the other thing to bear in mind is I think with technology, so much nowadays, we're used to instant gratification, you know, and I don't know, apps like TikTok, you scroll through and it's like you have to be hooked in the first like 3 seconds or you're just on to the next one. And so I think sometimes there is a danger with online dating in that you're expecting that instant connection straight away, but obviously you haven't had the time to really get to know that person. So I think authenticity is also just giving people a chance and giving people a moment to just settle in. Like, I almost didn't give my husband a third date because I didn't feel like there was enough. I felt like,
is this the story that you told before in reverse?
Yeah. It's ironic. But yeah, I felt like the way that I expected to connect, you know, on that kind of instant level with the kind of the banter and kind of quick fire, kind of sarcastic, kind of, you know, like the sparks. And I didn't feel like that was there. But I felt like, you know what, I'll just give it one more shot. And actually on the third date, that gave us time to go deeper. And we spoke about kind of our families, we spoke about our faith, and we realized that we had this whole pool of connection that was so much deeper than we could access on the first couple of dates. And I mean, obviously it ended up very happily, but I mean, I wouldn't have seen that if I hadn't have given it space to grow. So yeah, I think there's hope in just giving it space to grow.
Thank you very much. They're all fantastic answers and great contributions from you all. Thank you. So I think now we are going to have some questions from the floor.
Hi, noted. So my question is, I was raised in purity culture, and I think there was this sort of idea of like, God will decide who your life partner will be. And I guess I just wanted to ask you all what your take is of where God comes into this whole question.
Okay, I'm not sure we've got time for all, but who would like to...
So I think there's something interesting in what you're saying, Lamorna, about seeing and connecting with people as people made in the image of God and seeing them face to face and looking at them in the eye and connecting as human beings. And I think there is something of God in those things. I don't think that necessarily God, I'm not kind of Calvinist, I don't think that God says, you are going to marry this person and you're going to meet them on this date. But there are so many possibilities and so many connections with different people all over the world. And finding those connections, I think, is beautiful. I don't think it's necessarily like God ordained that, but there is, yeah, there's something beautiful in the connections.
I think, yeah, I agree. I mean, I feel like I could have ended up with lots of people. I don't believe that God has one specific person, but I do think that prayer really does come into it. I mean, I don't think I would have gone on the third date had I not prayed about it and just allowed the space to be like, you know what, I think I'll give it another go. So I think if you are someone who prays, if we pray about every other part of our lives, then why shouldn't we pray about dating? And that might not be that God comes down with a lightning bolt and it's like, this is the person for you. But it might just be, you know, if you're deciding whether or not you should ask someone out or whether or not to see someone again, rather than just making a decision based on like a snap feeling, praying about it and then giving it a day and then seeing how you feel after that, I think is really good.
Because I think purity culture teaches you not to trust yourself or not to know yourself very well. And that's one of the big challenges, I think. So I don't know if there's any other, Seth or Lamorna, if you have any thoughts on that. No, we will move along to the next question then.
It's from me. I always see that there's quite an interesting dynamic as you get older between being single and friends who are married, and that kind of idea that if you're single, you're living this great, free, amazing, full life, and if you're married, the grass is greener, right? Like, there's always that tension. What role do married or partnered people have in the lives of people who are single?
Would a married person like to answer this?
No. Vicky, what? No.
I mean, I could answer it as a married person and say that one thing that happened to me was that people stopped calling after I got married, in the sense that you've got everything you need now. So it was a reversal almost, that when birthdays came around, people would say, oh, well, what, where's he taking you? What's he going to do? And this idea that everything that was broader and more sociable and more integrated was almost seen as superfluous. So I think it's probably both ways. I think married people have a duty, or coupled people have a duty, as do single people, not to assume the grass is green and not to assume that you don't want those relationships. So that would be my married lady take on that. What
I agree. I also think it's really important to... I love people of all different types, single people, married people. I think it's good and important to have people over to your house who aren't just married people, who are a mixture of different things, because we're not just like in these rigid boxes. I think it's important for both me and my husband to meet with our friends individually as well as together as well. I think there is something probably of a self-consciousness, though, if I'm being honest, about if I was to marry, if I was to invite four couples and one single person, I would assume that a single person wouldn't want to be there. So one of the things that we could do is just have conversations with people, ask them what they think, how they feel. But I just don't think we should be in kind of rigid boxes of married or single. I think we should be friends with people and just be in community together.
Yeah. Any other thoughts from... the line?
I just think community is stronger when it's diverse, when there is mix of single and married. And, you know, married people need single friends, and I think single people need married friends as well.
Yeah. And that status can change very quickly for all kinds of reasons as well. It's not a fixed position often, is it? That can happen too. Next question.
Hello. First of all, thank you so much for the panel. This has been really, really interesting. And I recently read God is Not a White Man and absolutely loved it. So thank you for that. My question is actually about safety. Thinking sort of reflecting on my own experiences of dating apps, like as a trans person, if I'm out in a bar, if I'm out in a pub and I meet somebody and there's a spark or whatever, it's really difficult for me to know at what point do I just chuck in there that I'm trans and then have to sort of face the response of that person. And maybe they don't want to date a trans person, maybe I don't want to hear about that in a bar. So I guess my question is really about what role in kind of protecting ourselves and protecting our well-being and our safety can dating apps play?
I guess you've touched on a really valuable thing about social media, or about dating apps in that way, then, that it does allow you to decide in advance what you would like this person to know about you. I just think it's so hard and nuanced and complex a subject of like this thing of someone you've never met before, and the assumptions they make about you and the things you want them to know and you don't. It's so vulnerable inducing, and I don't think there's like a kind of one solution for anyone. But I suppose it's like having those friends around you who are going to be there if it does get difficult. Having a bit of a longer conversation with the person before you decide. I don't know. I actually don't have any good answer for this. I just think it's really difficult and challenging, and gender plays a massive role in that. And I guess that thing of like having to depend on other people doing some reading, doing some thinking for themselves so that they are going to ask the right questions, to respond, to have like a large enough knowledge about gender, about sexuality, that they are going to be able to hold your identity safely. And obviously we can never depend on that, but the more people write beautiful books like Sean Fay writing books that about being trans, and that these things that then people can then go to, means that they have a bit more knowledge coming in, and then it's not on the person themselves to feel like it's all up to them to explain themselves to other people. That's like the beauty of technology, is that the information is available out there. But it's hard.
My question is how to navigate dating when you're wanting to meet someone with a shared faith, but on the whole there are more women in the church than men. So just like how the church maybe handles that and approaches it.
So the question was how to navigate dating in the church when there are more women than men.
Shared faith. Yeah. And shared faith in particular.
And shared faith in particular, yeah.
I can start. I've got a story about that. So, kind of thinking about what Vicky said about actually things can change, like where things can change and people can change. So when my husband and I started dating, he had been raised in the church and then wasn't a Christian.
And I was a very public Christian. I was really disappointed by the how mean my Christian friends were to him and to that situation. It was really, really difficult. And I think that the reality is that there are more women in church than men, although I don't know if that's changing in the next few years. So the reality is that if the church puts marriage on a pedestal, it has got to be okay with people marrying of different faiths or people from outside the church. The reason why I said things change is because actually my husband and I have been married for 10 years, coming up to 10 years, and he's like, he is a Christian now. He's been to church pretty much every week of those 10 years, whereas some of the people that were kind of quite mean have not, or have fallen away from the faith. So we just cannot treat people and put people in these boxes and treat them in such kind of mean and exclusive ways. So I think I'm all up for it. Although, yes, recognising that there are challenges if you really, really, really want to meet someone of a particular faith. But knowing that Christianity is a lot of different things to a lot of different people. That is a very, very big box. So finding someone who is the type of Christian that you want, the kind of theology that you want, the kind of politics as well, that is the right, there are so many things that we're kind of making things narrower and narrower and narrower for people. So I think we just need to be a bit more chill.
Yeah. I actually wrote a chapter in my last book, which was about Christianity and relationships, and it was called something like, "So You've Decided to Date a Non-Christian," and it basically tackled all of these things, the fact there is a number differential and the fact that things do change. You can meet someone, they may be on their own journey. I've heard that quite a lot. I had 1500 people reply to my survey. I had so many stories come in, and lots of this was either we thought we were compatible because we were both Christians and it turned out we weren't, or we thought we were completely different because one of us wasn't a Christian, and then things evolved and we found common ground, or they've shared my faith now, or something else happened. So I think that very fixed thing that the church likes to put on people is very movable, in fact, and we all change as individuals. We all evolve. Our faith evolves. It doesn't stay exactly the same. So I think you do have to develop discernment, develop confidence to explore that and what it might look like, and not necessarily rule someone out because they don't tick everything on a list. So would be my story. Any other takes?
I would also just say, I mean, if you are a woman wanting to date a man and there aren't any men in your church, then I think, as you know, and as a charity, a single friendly church, we find that, you know, church isn't always a great place for you know, to be single in. And so just because someone isn't in church doesn't mean that they're not a Christian. Sometimes people have just had really difficult experiences of church, and particularly you find with some people, you know, they don't want to go to church on their own. Like, that is a huge barrier, attending church. So actually, you know, they don't go, or they go sporadically, or you just won't see them because they'll sit at the back and then they'll leave straight away. So there are people out there, there's loads of Christians, there's loads of Christian men out there who just aren't in church, or perhaps they're going sporadically, and sometimes they might be on dating apps, sometimes they might be at a festival like Greenbelt, you know, but perhaps they're not sitting, you know, in the church on a Sunday morning or evening.
Do we have time for one more question? And then I think it's the end of the panel.
Just quickly, thank you so much. It's fantastic Greenbelt are doing this. I'd like to put my hand up for the older people here in their 50s and 60s, and particularly for the widowed community, of which I am one. I was widowed at 61, and my kids want me to find someone. So what my question is my experience of dating apps is dreadful. It's the Wild West out there. And I'd love to hear, as we close tonight, what do you do when it's that bad?
Oh, you're all looking at me. Do you want to go say something, sir?
I think it was touched on before. There are people now that are going beyond the dating apps and joining like running clubs or different like hobby clubs and stuff that you can meet people in community, in safe spaces, beyond your comfort zone or your church or whatever you find as your third place. And you'll be surprised, you know, the sparks that could fly in that. I don't know who I am giving you this advice, but I see on TikTok that people are joining running clubs, which is quite ironic. And they're finding their spouses there. So, yeah. Let's go running.
Ultimate authority these days, isn't it? One thing I would say is, having interviewed lots of couples, lots of people at different stages of their lives, hearing from hundreds, if not thousands of people, is that timing plays such a huge part in this. So, I mean, I've certainly encountered people who've met in their 80s, who've both been widowed, people who thought it was too late when they were, you know, 22. It's when it's the right person, when you encounter the right person at the right time, suddenly you go, oh, that's why, you know, not in the sense of, you know, that person drops in like, you know, an amazing sunset and there they are in front of you, but just timing, you know, lots of, it may feel difficult at different times, but then you will find that people do actually manage to connect with people when it's right for both people. Sometimes one person could be single for a long time and the other person is not single for very long. You just don't know what those pieces are. So I think in person is really important. There is a single straight Christian Connection event tomorrow, a quiz tomorrow to get people just meeting in person. So anything like that, anything that comes up where there's just a chance to meet face to face as well as online, I think is great. And I would encourage that as well. But I would say it's almost hard for me to feel discouraged because I've heard so many positive stories. And when you hear the stories and it's just like, oh, it just happened to be, if I hadn't been online at that particular day, or if I just closed my account on that particular day, or if I hadn't gone to that event on that day. I mean, a friend's story, a wedding that I went to recently, where they'd waved each other on different apps, and then he'd said, oh, I actually want to meet someone in person, I don't want to do it on apps after all. And she just happened to be in a particular town on Easter Sunday, and she just happened to walk into his church not knowing it was his church. And I went to their wedding this year, and it was completely kind of out of the blue, you know, but they had met on an app, and then they got married because they also met in person. So I think these things just have a way of surprising you, and there is an element of endurance sometimes and perseverance, but it pays off in some quite beautiful ways quite often. So if that's any encouragement, I don't know. Any final words from anyone else? No. That's dating solved. I hope you're all feeling highly satisfied now. And thank you ever so much for coming. Thank you to all the amazing panellists, Ginny McDonald, Mona Ash, Beth Phillip and Beth Chan.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.